There are reports in the Russian media of people literally within 2 weeks of being conscripted, being killed on the battlefield in Ukraine.
It's Monday, October 17th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Later in the show, we'll hear from a neuroscientist and one-time sound engineer for Prince about why we like the music we like. But first, people in Kyiv woke up to another barrage of Russian strikes today. The latest assault on cities across Ukraine also includes attacks on energy infrastructure, and Ukrainians are being urged to conserve power so there won't need to be emergency shutdowns. Missy Ryan covers national security for The Washington Post. She just got back from Ukraine and spoke to Peter O'Dowd.
So Ukrainian President Zelensky has said that the Russians are terrorizing civilians with what are called kamikaze drones in Kyiv. Tell us about the latest attacks in the capital today.
Sure. Well, this is the second time in 1 week that Ukrainians woke up to the sound of airstrikes in the capital, which, as you know, was relatively quiet for months as the fighting took place in central and eastern Ukraine. And so that today's strike, which involved kamikaze drones, really are a reminder of the vulnerability of Ukrainian cities. And it sort of underscores this plea that President Zelensky is making and other Ukrainian leaders are making for additional air defense systems and assistance from the West.
Missy, do you get the sense that the drone attacks on Ukrainian cities are doing anything to change the reality that Russia is faltering on the front lines of the war?
They're really not. And if you ask Ukrainian officials, it's a sign of the flagging nature of the campaign that President Vladimir Putin is undertaking. But it also really does have a psychological effect. We spoke to many Ukrainians who, you know, obviously expressed concerns, who worried about their children going to school or elderly relatives who are sometimes hesitant to comply with the air alert sirens that go off all the time in Kyiv. But we also heard defiance that people are not planning to leave Ukraine, that they've come, many people have come back after the initial months of the war, and they're there to stay.
Sure. There's also some discussion now, or a lot of discussion, about where these weapons are coming from. Ukrainian and U.S. officials say the Iranians are supplying the drones to Russia. Iran denies it. But what do we know about Iran's deepening involvement, allegedly, in this war?
Yeah, well, according to the government, it's well established that there have been these masses, hundreds and hundreds of drones that have been supplied, relatively cheap, quickly produced drones that Iran has used in other places like Yemen are now being supplied to Russia. And the Washington Post reported over the weekend that Iran is also planning to supply short-range ballistic missiles, which would be a significant escalation in Iran's involvement in the war.
What's the motivation for Iran to do that?
Well, it's a way for Iran to sort of poke the United States and its European allies and also strengthen its relationship with Russia. I mean, there's sort of a mutual dependency that's there as Iran is increasingly isolated from the rest of the world. Also, Russia needs this military hardware because it's really blown through a lot of its missile stocks since the beginning of the war. As you recall, Putin expected the war to be over in a matter of weeks, and now it's been almost 8 months.
Well, speaking of international alliance, there is also news that Russia and Belarus are forming a joint regional force, that 9,000 Russian troops are going to be stationed in Belarus just over the border from Ukraine. What do you make of that? Are the Russians planning for another attack from the north?
It's possible. I you know, they were very clearly repulsed in February and March from the capital, Kyiv, and the Ukrainian defensives have significantly hardened since then. So I do think it's not likely that they would try to launch another ground offensive from Belarus into Kyiv. You know, remember, that would be the closest launching point for them to get to the Ukrainian capital. They could be using it to stage missile attacks, and certainly what we have heard from Ukrainian officials is that many of the drone attacks are launched from Belarus. So, I mean, you know, the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, is one of Putin's only allies at this point, our strongest allies in Europe. He at once, you know, sort of is dependent on Russia and needs to allow Putin to use his country as a staging ground. But there have also been signals from the government in Belarus that they do not want to get involved in a sort of direct military conflict with Ukraine.
Finally, Missy Ryan, I want to ask you about the men that Russia has been rounding up to fight in this war to refresh its depleted troops. Tell me about these conscripts. Have they arrived on the front lines yet, and are they having any impact on the fighting?
They have arrived on the front lines. There are already reports of Russian conscripts being killed. There are reports in the Russian media of people literally within 2 weeks of being conscripted being killed on the battlefield in Ukraine. And the fact that Russia is rushing these people into Ukraine without adequate training and also without adequate protection and equipment that they need to operate successfully is really a sign of Putin's increasing troubles in Ukraine and the likelihood that Ukrainians are going to make some more advances in their counteroffensive.
Missy Ryan covers national security for our partners at The Washington Post. Missy, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Republican effort to recruit poll workers to police supposed election fraud. That's after the break. Something like a million Americans will sign up to run polling sites across the country between now and Election Day, November 8th. Some of them will be supporters of President Trump's lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Take Macomb County, Michigan, just north of Detroit, which earlier this year hired Genevieve Peters to help recruit poll workers. Peters was in D.C. last year for the insurrection. Here she is in a selfie video after Trump supporters stormed the Capitol.
We let our voices be heard that we're not taking this fraudulent election and we are not going to stand down. This is not over. This is only the beginning.
Politico investigative correspondent Heidi Prisbella looked into what's going on in Macomb County, Michigan, and how it fits into the Republican National Committee's broader efforts to install Trump supporters as poll workers in key states. Here's Robin Young.
You write that Macomb County has hired Genevieve Peters, who was at the January 6th rally. She was also at a Proud Boys rally at the Michigan Capitol. She was at an armed protest outside the home of the Secretary of State there in Michigan. Now, she's had past experience working on elections, running elections in Los Angeles. But what does Macomb County say about hiring her to hire their poll workers?
Yeah, great question, Robin. And when I called up and talked to the Macomb County clerk, he was aware of the fact that she had been active in the January 6th protest. I'm not sure he was clear on exactly everything that she had done, which, Robin, let me tell you, that includes footage of her bringing her own stage platform and microphone and loudspeakers, and really, in the words of local news station, firing up the agitators and telling them that they should march forward, that we have breached the Capitol, that, hey, don't worry, even if you're arrested, there's no better cause than this. And it was unclear to me that he knew the extent of her activities that day. Even so, he said, look, her past involvement in what she did in her personal life has not been reflected in what she's doing in her job right now. But of course, once this has become known more widely in Michigan, I'm getting a lot of feedback from individuals who are deeply concerned, as well as elections experts, because she's recruiting, number one. But number two, I was told directly by the clerk that she's also putting together training materials. So there's a lot of questions about what's happening there? Because based on my previous reporting, the RNC workshops were training individuals who had never been poll workers before, specifically on how to contest specific votes in voters and how to challenge clerks on processes, which they really aren't familiar with as first-time poll workers.
Well, let's be clear, because it's poll workers that we're talking about, and poll workers are, as one told us, they're kind of the traffic cops. They're the face of elections. They're the people who greet you, check you in, tell you what lane to go in. It's poll watchers who might be put up by candidates or parties who are there as the police. If one's the traffic cop, they're kind of the police, and they're there to look for irregularities, and they're trained to do that. And again, they're put up by partisan parties. But that we're not talking about poll watchers. We're talking about poll workers who, it sounds like, are being turned into poll watchers. And this isn't just anecdotal. When you first reported on this back in June, you had tape of the RNC, the Republican National Committee, Michigan director. This is Rob Bucetis. He's recruiting people at workshops to work the polls, and here's what he was telling them.
I understand that we are upset with the 2020 results, but we cannot just look at the 2020 results, or else the exact same thing will happen in 2022. We need volunteers on the ground on election day, ahead of election day, working so that that fraud does not happen again.
Okay, so it's people who think the elections were fraud. He's saying they're working to ferret out fraud. That is not the job of a poll worker. But what other indication did you have that that's what they're going to be doing there?
Right. Well, there was a lot of recordings there. It was 8 months worth of recordings of trainings that are taking place in Michigan. But this is happening across the country. There are RNC, so-called RNC election integrity directors in 12 battleground states, at least, that are holding similar workshops. Now, in this case, you have the RNC actually collecting, recruiting and collecting the names of individuals who they want to place in largely Democratic districts where they say there is not a balance, a partisan balance among poll workers that there should be. But in this case, it is a partisan organization that's recruiting them, number one, and then number two, training them in these workshops to do a number of things, like challenging clerks on their processes, even challenging potentially individual voters. I had a slide that was titled, quote, "How to Challenge a Voter." Just to be clear, Robin, the DNC does not do this. And the RNC had been under, essentially barred for a couple of decades from doing any type of work related to election integrity since the early 1980s when the RNC had sent armed individuals to minority districts. And a judge put a consent decree and said, you cannot do this type of work. It was lifted in 2018. So in 2020, what we saw was a lot of poll challengers outside these polling locations when things got heated. But that operation has gotten much more sleek, much more organized, and in numerous states. And the goal is not to be on the outside. The goal is to be on the inside and to have these individuals serving as actual poll workers. The optimistic take here from individuals who I talk to on this is that, you know, maybe a lot of these folks who falsely believe that there's fraud and our system is rife with fraud, once they get on the inside, they will see that that's not true and that, you know, the most exciting thing they're doing is handing out the I voted stickers. But there's also a lot of potential problems that this could cause, which we can also get into.
Well, I just will name a couple. There was a far-right candidate for governor in Michigan who did not win the primary, but he was encouraging poll workers to unplug election equipment if they believe something was wrong. Also telling people to bring in their cell phones, which is barred. And your reporting uncovered that it's not just training of potential poll workers that the RNC is doing. They also have a list of lawyers standing by that these people are to call. But when you say the DNC doesn't do this, this has never been done. We spoke to a poll worker who, when I told her about your reporting, was horrified. She said, I don't even know if my fellow poll workers are Democratic or Republican. We're not allowed to talk about it. This sounds like if this is bringing in poll workers, they're going to be doing some of the things they're being trained to do, like challenge a voter. That is going to lead to problems with elections, and that is going to create the fraud and the lack of faith in elections that is there now based on nothing. It will be based on something.
These are the biggest concerns. Number one, that they're just going to bog down the clerks with unnecessary work and challenges and demands and take them away from their jobs. Lastly, when you refer to the hotline that was being created for these individuals, the concern here is really that even if there's no successful challenges to voters, what it will do is create this smokescreen and a haze of uncertainty around elections in particular districts, primarily Democratic, heavily minority districts, that will give the pretense to GOP legislatures potentially to say, hey, the election in this district was not on the up and up, and therefore we can't certify these results. There's many, many concerns here of also individuals taking what are just normal events, like people helping folks put ballots into ballot drop boxes and creating social media storms in ginning up this narrative, again, falsely, right, that there's fraud in our system when, in fact, 2020 was probably one of the safest elections we've ever had and under pretty significant conditions with the pandemic going on.
Heidi Prisbella, again, investigative correspondent for Politico, who's been really pulling on this thread of a move to put partisans in the position of poll workers in American elections. And we're going to stay in touch with you, Heidi. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Coming up, Robin talks to a neuroscientist about why some songs do it for us and others don't. And yeah, she's got a PhD, but more importantly, she worked for Prince. That's after the break.
You have your favorite song, right? The one that speaks to you? This is one of mine, Glen Campbell singing Jimmy Webb's Wichita Lineman.
I hear you singing in the wire. I can hear you through the whine. And the Wichita Lineman is still on the line.
Maybe that leaves you cold. Why do some of us adore that song, some don't? Why do some prefer the Rolling Stones to the Beatles? Why have I formed a religion around Joni Mitchell, but sometimes can't remember her lyrics? Well, a new book explores how sweet spots in our brain steer us to different aspects of music, and the author knows a thing or two about this. When Susan Rogers was just 20, she was loving Zeppelin at the Forum in L.A., but she had to leave because her husband kind of resented her love of concerts. Well, right then and there, fist high, she made a vow to the rafters that one day she'd return to the Forum and mix live sound for an amazing band. And she did. She became sound engineer for Prince, in studio and on the road, on hits including Purple Rain. Susan Rogers is now a multi-platinum record producer. She's also a professor at the Berklee College of Music and a cognitive neuroscientist. She's been busy. Her new book is This Is What It Sounds Like, which she co-wrote with Ogi Ogas, who has a PhD in computational neuroscience. Susan Rogers, welcome.
Oh, hello. Thank you, Robin. I'm really happy to be on the show. You mentioned Wichita Lineman.
Yeah.
That song makes me weak in the knees.
I know.
I love it so much.
Okay, well, just talk for 2 seconds about that. What do you think it is about Wichita Lineman within the context of what you teach us in the book?
I think it's maybe melody more than it is lyrics. If I looked at the lyrics on the page, I don't think they do for me what some other lyrics do. But for that particular song, oh, that melody just kills me.
Well, and for some people, as you point out, it would be the words. It would be the story. They picture a lineman out on a pole and, you know, they're not having the feelings of the melody that are maybe bringing up other images for them. So let's hear how you think about these sweet spots in our brains.
Yes, in this book, Ogi and I talk about 7 dimensions of music listening, each one of which can give you a jolt of pleasure. 4 of them apply to music, and that is melody, lyrics, rhythm, and timbre. Timbre is sound itself. And the other 3 are aesthetic dimensions that apply to ballet and opera and movies and television and novels. And that would be authenticity, which is your perception of where the expressive gestures are coming from, and novelty versus familiarity. Some of us like those groundbreaking works, and others like our art to be a little bit more familiar. And then the last one is realism versus abstraction. Some of us like works of art that are grounded in the real physical world, and others like works of art that are a little bit more reflective of an imaginary world.
Staying with this idea of melody being a sweet spot, you talk about Frank Sinatra in his later years, a master of melody. I didn't realize how much he studied it. Let's listen to his 1966 version of It Was a Very Good Year first.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for small town girls and soft summer nights. We'd hide from the lights on the village green. I was 17.
Okay, Susan, I can imagine some listeners saying, oh my God, I had to hear this every single second for like a decade. But I hear it new now, having read some of the things you describe Sinatra working so hard to do. Can you tick off just some of the things that he did, like how he trained his voice?
Oh, he trained his voice by, first off, learning something kind of like circular breathing. Sinatra reasoned that if he could learn to actually inhale at the same time while he was kind of exhaling, kind of a circular breathing kind of thing, he could make his vocal phrases last longer than normal. And that imparts to the listener this subtext of great lung power and virility. Yeah. He took up running and swimming, and there were rumors that Sinatra had an extra rib, but I don't know if that was true.
Okay, so there's just a look at melody, and again, there's so much more in the book. But then lyrics. You point to a particular song, Lana Del Rey's This Is What Makes Us Girls. Let's listen.
Remember how we used to party up all night, sneaking out, looking for a taste of real life, drinking in the small town firelight.
Pabst Blue Ribbon on ice.
Sweet 16 and we had arrived, walking down the streets as they whistle high, high, stealing bullies' cars with the senior guys. Except we never make it out alive.
Okay, Susan Rogers, I am in a movie now, and I don't think that would be the same without the Pabst Blue Ribbon on ice.
And walking down the street while they whistle high, high, don't we know exactly what she's talking about?
Yeah.
Such evocative lyrics. So sometimes when we are craving a musical treat, sometimes we want to move our bodies and we're going to select a record that matches our rhythmic sweet spot. Other times we want imagery, we want poetry. We're going to select those lyricists that do that for us. Other times we want a record to match our feelings or to get us to feel a certain thing. And we're going to choose a record with a strong melody. Sometimes we want to be cognitively impressed. We're going to choose a record that has a certain style that we like. Every single time we reach for that computer mouse or that button on our phone in order to play a song, that's indicative that your brain wants something. It's craving a certain kind of treat, and it knows from past experience the records in your playlist that are going to deliver that particular treat for you.
Susan Rogers, a couple things. First, I can see why Prince loved you. I mean, what an intimate relationship to work with an artist, helping them create their sound. Can you tell us a little bit about how the heck did this happen? You go from, you know, a 20-year-old with your, you know, defiant vow that you're going to mix live some great somebody's music someday, and then you're doing it.
I've always had a passion for music, but I had no compulsion to want to be a performer or a songwriter or anything like that. I wanted to be someone who assisted in the making of records, kind of a midwife for records being birthed into the world. I started in 1978, and you wouldn't see a lot of women recording engineers or record producers. I never saw any. But the thing I could do that would give me entree into the studio was being an audio technician. My job in Hollywood in the late 70s, early 80s was to repair the equipment, the consoles and the tape machines and things. But in 1983, just as he was coming off the 1999 tour, Prince sent out the word that he was looking for a technician. He hired me. He liked working with women because he was Prince. He could transition me from the technician role of working way behind the scenes to the engineering role and being a little bit artistically more creative. Eventually, I was able to parlay that into a career as a record producer.
Well, we want to make sure we touch on authenticity. Something feels authentic to you, and it may not to other people at all. And you use as an example a band we've talked about here on the program, which is the Shags. Sisters, their dad was convinced they'd be a great musical band back in the 60s, 70s, but they had no formal training. And when the dad brought them in to record, the engineers couldn't believe what they were hearing. Let's listen. This is I'm So Happy When You're Near.
I'm so happy when you're near. I'm so sad when you're away.
Okay, the Shags. You rave about them. So did Frank Zappa, Rolling Stone. Why?
To folks in the music business, the Shags are a very valuable reminder of what true musical intentionality sounds like. If you take a child's finger painting, you can look at that finger painting and you know it's never going to hang in a museum. There's zero technique there in a toddler's finger painting. That finger painting represents pure intentionality. A little child thinking to him or herself, I want to show what my world is like, minus any technique whatsoever. That purity of intention is raw and naked in the Shags. So when we have an artist in the studio and they're on the other side of the control room glass and they're playing every note perfectly, but you can tell that their head isn't in it, they're just going through the motions, that's when you want to remind them, listen to the Shags. Because there's so much gusto in what they're playing, and the wrong note played with gusto is always going to sound better than the right note played timidly. We need the Shags because they're at the extreme end of the dimension of authenticity.
That's Susan Rogers, co-author with Ogi Ogas of This Is What It Sounds Like with the Music You Love Says About You. She's a cognitive neuroscientist and also a professor at the Berklee College of Music. Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin. It was a pleasure.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Head to hereandnow.org for more on the stories you heard today and how prolonged drought is changing the face of water management in the West.
This water that we're drinking today, probably about 30 hours ago, was raw sewage coming through the sewer collection system.
Don't knock it till you try it, I guess. Today's stories were produced by Julia Corcoran, Lynn Menegon, and Emiko Tamagawa. Gabe Bullard, Jill Ryan, and Tinku Ray edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Mike, Max, and I wrote the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carleen Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.